I think Mubarak time in office is to be counted in hours, if not possible days. I don't think he has much support among the Egyptian populace, but I also think that the military establishment, which is really the power behind the throne, is ready to sacrifice its own power base and benefits for Mubarak, which also gets us into that the military establishment has very strong links to the United States. And I think the United States would like to rescue the structure of relations at the expense of removing Mubarak and possibly some of the higher figures that have been the focal point of the discontent. So if my sense is correct, that there is an attempt to manage the crisis and to try to provide a political transition that maintains the parameter of the political structure and relations between Egypt, the United States, and Israel in the way that it's been formatted for at least since 1978-79. Whether that is successful or not will depend on the ability of the political organizers, the popular uprising in Egypt, and whether the leadership on the ground is able to assert itself. And I don't think they will be able to negate the military power, but if they are able to construct some type of a political base to at least defend the gains that emerge from this popular uprising. And I think the next few days are very critical. I think the United States have sent one of its ambassadors down, a career diplomat, and my sense he is there to manage the transition and the crisis. Our defense secretary put a call to the Egyptian head of the military, and therefore my sense is they're managing the crisis from the military side of the equation. And it's interesting, both Egypt and Tunisia were seen as the model for the United States for quite a long time, even though that they had problems with the personality of Mubarak and Zain al-Abidin. Structurally, they felt that these are two model states, in particular on the privatization and in the neoliberal economic model, and on countering what they deemed to be the Islamist movements in both. Actually, Tunisia was seen as to be the model of what's called drying the springs or drying the sources for Islamist organizing, which included shutting down their political parties, closing down their what's called zakat or charity work, closing down their infrastructure that deals with social issues and social problems, and completely stifle any attempt for them to be part of civil society, as well as engaging in mass arrests, deportation in the cases of the leadership, torture. All those were part and parcel of the package of tools that the Tunisian system was implementing and was seen as the model. A number of years ongoing, the Tunisian's foreign ministry was holding almost a meeting with all the Arab foreign ministers and interior ministers of how to deal with the Islamist threat in there. So as such, Tunisia was instrumental in that. And similarly, Egypt was instrumental fulfilling a number of functions, including subcontracting torture through the war on terrorism and the extraordinary rendition. So as such, these two countries essentially were part and parcel of the overall global war on terrorism, as well as the United States' attempt to manage the Middle East and to take it into its own direction over the past 30 years, if not more.
It seems that there is a difference between Tunisia and Egypt on this subject. We haven't heard for a long time about Islamist party or figures in Tunisia, but we always hear things about the Muslim Brotherhood, for example, in Egypt. They never were able to really neutralize them.
Well, actually, Tunisia had one of the early manifestation of the Islamist movement in the Rashid al-Ghannouchi and the Nahda movement in there. But Tunisia was thought to be successful in wiping out, at least that's in wiping out the Islamist in Tunisia. So much so that no one would actually say that there is such thing as an Islamist movement. The leadership was sent to exile. And as such, they truly believed that they were able to, quote unquote, move Tunisia into modernity. It's an insulting term, but nevertheless, that they moved them into modernity by cutting any link to Islam or Islamist movements in Tunisia. But as we see, exiling leadership, arresting individuals, closing down all the centers, and so much so to also closing mosques at certain instances, and having unified sermons that are given from the Interior Ministry, if anything, it provided the context for people to go underground and to go outside of the normal arenas, and as such, the movement was there. Now, the difference is that Egypt is the hub of the Arab world intellectually, is the hub of the Arab world politically. It also provides considerable labor force across the Middle East. If you think of Jordan, Iraq, Syria, but all the Gulf states, the Egyptian labor force is the one that really provides the infrastructure in there. Also, Egypt is the media center. It's the Hollywood of the Arab world. Even though that to say the Hollywood has its own what you call problematic construct, but Egypt is a major producer of media material that is consumed the Arab world. So whatever takes place in Egypt, by necessity, has far more eyes on it, far more cameras on it, and far more interest in it. In addition, the fact that Egypt signed a peace treaty with Israel, there is constantly an alertness to anything that takes place, because Egypt's peace treaty with Israel in 1978-79, the Camp David Agreement, removed the biggest part of the Arab world confrontation with Israel from the equation, and therefore the focus on the Muslim Brotherhood in there was, in general, as a way to make sure that we are keeping the points of pressure to prevent a possible collapse or a change in that strategic relationship that has lasted at least since 1978 till today. So there is a difference, but the difference, I think, is in terms of the interest and the focus, not in terms of the whether there was presence in there or not. In addition, I think both Tunisia and Egypt have a very well-established political opposition that had almost 60 to 70 years in existence. They both have fought or challenged colonial structures. They both had come out of a confrontation with colonial powers, England and France. They both had an educated class that were educated in the ex-colonial motherlands, and therefore they were highly aware. But as they ended their colonial period, those who came into power were both partly colonial in terms of their political economic views, at the same time attempting to construct an anti-colonial perspective. So as we are witnessing what is occurring, I think it's important for us to notice that these two states are moving, at least in terms of politically, from the 1950s, they were colonial states. They moved into an anti-colonial structure or a post-colonial structure. And now possibly, where it's a possibility, that they might move into an anti- and decolonized structure. And the next few years and a few months might determine whether they are able to emerge as a decolonized states. It's a very, I would say, a very difficult construct, but it's very problematic in terms of where to move forward.